Woodrow Wilson's foes called him an ideologue, a hypocrite, and a coward. His admirers thought he was the hero who put forth the best hope for the world. Teddy Roosevelt labeled him a prize jackass. When Wilson died, eulogists compared him to Icarus. Today, Wilson inspires feelings that are just as extreme and contradictory. His name has become a flashpoint in the debate over using American might to spread American ideals. Obscured by Wilsonianism, however, is the man himself. Wilson comes alive in John Milton Cooper Jr.'s insightful and important biography, Woodrow Wilson. Wilson could be stubborn or reflective, idealistic or canny, a visionary who was too often blind. That's from Louisa Thomas's review in Newsweek of John Cooper's new biography of our 28th president, Woodrow Wilson. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
How does Woodrow Wilson rank among the other American presidents? How did his background as an academic and as a staunch Presbyterian shape his politics? What were his significant accomplishments as a legislative reformer and wartime president? And what makes him a figure both noble and flawed? Joining us for an exploration of what he calls one of the deepest and most daring souls ever to inhabit the White House is John Milton Cooper, Professor Emeritus of History at the UW-Madison and author most recently of Woodrow Wilson, A Biography.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Very nice to be back here.
Always a pleasure. I think of Wilson, well, deep and daring as a pivotal figure, and sometimes the pivotal figure is the one responsible for the pivoting, I guess you could say. But when I think of some of the firsts and onlys and first in a long times of Woodrow Wilson, several things come to mind. First Southern president since Zachary Taylor.
Southern-born president to be elected.
Yeah,
Andrew
right.
Johnson was Southern-born.
By accident.
Right.
A first Ph.D.?
First and only. Only professional academic. Only one who spent his professional life in academic life. In fact, after I wrote the book, I got thinking about this. Wilson is really, I think you could say, is the only president who ever rose to the very top in a private profession, something separated from public life. In fact, in two of them. One was he became a great scholar. He's regarded as one of seven or eight great political scientists that this country has produced, so as a scholar. And then he's also ranked up there among the first top five of university presidents. So, and as we know, those two things are not the same thing necessarily. Mm-hmm. Great scholars don't necessarily make great university presidents and vice versa. But yeah, he did all of those things.
Second to the last president, you tell us, to write his own speeches.
That's correct. The last one was Herbert Hoover, which perhaps not the best example. It never occurred to Wilson not to. He was a professor. He was used to talking. In fact, he preferred to talk without notes or with very, very sketchy notes. There is some speculation that that may have been a way that he overcame a slight tendency toward dyslexia. He did not learn to read until he was 10 or 11, and never became a natural speed reader, although he was very disciplined. He knew how to extract things from books and from what he read so that he compensated. Another thing he did to compensate was just before he went to college, he learned shorthand. He took a correspondence course and taught himself shorthand. And one of the things you can do is really you can go back to his shorthand notes, although it takes experts. It's an archaic form of shorthand now to decipher those. And you can actually get inside his thinking, you know, his thinking before he delivered a speech or before he wrote something. The other thing he did was pretty early he got a typewriter, which was like getting a computer in the 1960s. He was you can see these kind of compensatory devices that he had for reading didn't come completely naturally to him.
Came back to the State of the Union address.
He revived the custom that Washington and John Adams had, which was that they would go down and give the State of the Union address in person to Congress. Jefferson discontinued it because Jefferson was a poor public speaker and he wanted to emphasize the separation of powers. Wilson revived it because he wanted to diminish the separation of powers. And in fact, it was not just the State of the Union address. Whenever he had an important subject to address the country about, he would go before Congress. Now, part of that is that's the pre-radio, pre-television days, so that's his way of getting a national audience. But again, he wanted to He wanted to make himself a presence on Capitol Hill, and one of the things he did as a political scientist was to compare our system with a parliamentary system. And he thought in certain respects the parliamentary system was quite superior and that a president ought to be a prime minister. The other thing he did in that, besides the symbolism of being there in person, was he worked through the party. The party then and now is not one of the better-loved political institutions, but very early he said parties are not a necessary evil. They're necessary and they can be very good. And he believed in party government and party leadership.
Did he give press conferences?
He did, and that's an interesting story. He gave press conferences not to be quoted, which in fact is that I believe is true until either Truman or Eisenhower, that the president would meet with the press. This was kind of background. And if he wanted something to get out, he'd say, okay, boys, you can quote me on that one. No women yet in the press corps, I think not until the 30s. And he met for the first 2 years of his presidency, he met once or twice a week with the press with very, very frank and easygoing give and take there. He was really, really rather good at it. He discontinued it after the sinking of the Lusitania. His secretary and his, part of political factotum, Joe Tumulty, kept pressing him to do it again. He did it once after he was reelected, but then we went into the war. He stopped it. He did it once again when he brought the peace treaty back. He was good at it, but I think it was something that he was wary of doing. In other words, it wasn't something, again, that came quite naturally to him.
You have a sentence in your biography where you write, "Behind Woodrow Wilson's distinctive and often caricatured features, his long nose, big jaw, and pince-nez eyeglasses lay one of the deepest and most daring souls ever to inhabit the White House." You've got a picture of him on the cover of your book where he does have this sort of intellectual look, the little glasses. Mm-hmm. That seems kind of at odds with adjectives like daring and deepest and so on.
Well, an earlier book I wrote, if I can give a plug for another one, was a comparative biography of him and Theodore Roosevelt. And in fact, of the two, their public images, I think, are exactly the reverse of what they were. Theodore Roosevelt was actually a rather cautious and calculating politician. When he took a bold action, it was one because he'd thought it through very much before and was doing it deliberately. Wilson was quite deliberate too, but this is a man who, given a choice of doing things, the cautious way or the bold way, I'd say 8 times out of 10 he would choose the bold way. He made a very interesting offhand comment to his brother-in-law, who was also a fellow faculty member at Princeton, probably his closest adult friend. This is when he had lost out on his second battle for reforming at Princeton, and he was being courted to run for governor of New Jersey. And he said to his brother-in-law, he said, "I don't have any interest in staying around here and running a country club. If I can't improve something, I can't get thoroughly interested in it." So it's this itch to improve. It's this itch to take bold action that I think it really is part of it.
And when he chose to become a scholar, to do the academic route, the PhD, did he already have sort of political ambitions?
Well, that's an interesting story. In fact, there's a famous letter. Some of the best letters, I think, that a president has ever written to his spouse are Wilson to his first wife, the woman who became his first wife, Ellen Axon. I think they rank up there with John and Abigail Adams. And her letters to him are awfully good, too. He said to her, he's kind of explaining things to her. He said, "The profession I chose was politics. The profession I entered was law because I thought the one would lead to the other." He'd gone to law school and then practiced for a couple of years in Atlanta. And he said, "I thought the one would lead to the other," but then he said, "No, I found that if I stuck around at the law in order to get enough independent income and standing, I would have ground myself down and I wouldn't be any good for the sort of the big things and the big thinking he wanted to do in politics." Well, that was true enough, although by the time he finished college, he was fascinated with writing. He wanted to write, and wanted to write about politics. And I think he went to law school in part to satisfy his father. Went to law school, okay, I'll try that, and I'll try the law. Okay, been there, done that. Now I want to do academia. He believed when he left the law that he was, in a sense, taking the veil, that was it for elective politics. He did have some ideas about being an advisor, a commentator, maybe an appointee, a precursor, domestic politics, kind of precursor to somebody like Kissinger or Brzezinski. It didn't work out that way. He actually got much more absorbed in teaching and writing than he thought he would, and was not, despite the fact that one of the things he preached to his students was be engaged in politics, take part in public life, He didn't do that much himself. He voted, kind of followed the issues, not a lot, though. The one issue that he got really excited about before he became president of Princeton was the war with Spain in 1898 and then taking the Philippines. And one of the things that was, to me, was quite a discovery when I went through that some years ago was he was a very enthusiastic imperialist. He's very much like Theodore Roosevelt in that respect.
Which is counter to our image of him at Versailles.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, at Paris. The conference was at Paris. They signed the treaty at Versailles. I once had an interesting experience. This was some years ago. We were on a little tour, and we went through an anteroom to the Hall of Mirrors where the treaty was signed. And the guide said, showed us this table, which was a decent-sized table, nothing special. She said, this was Louis XIV's writing desk and council table. And she said, and this was the treaty on the table on which the Treaty of Versailles was signed in 1919. So I asked her why, and she said, ah, monsieur, I take it you are not German. I said, no. She said, if you were, you would know. The Germans, the Prussians, had made the French sign their treaty in 1870. So it's tit for tat. Revenge goes back and forth between those two nations.
If I remember, the title of your earlier book on Roosevelt and Wilson was The Warrior and the Priest, the subtitle. Is that right?
That's the title.
And the priest referring to Wilson.
No, actually not. Those are Nietzsche's terms. You know, those are Nietzsche's terms about the will to power. I think Theodore Roosevelt, if any character, historical character in public life anyway, lived up to Nietzsche's warrior, you bet it was Theodore Roosevelt. But actually, Wilson was not Nietzsche's priest. He seems to be. The priest is the one who thwarts the will to power and who has to put it through ideals or religion or something like that, which Nietzsche says is terrible. Wilson wasn't that way. I think one of the most difficult terms to deal with describing Wilson is idealist. He was. But then so, frankly, every other major figure in public life in America at that time was an idealist. And nothing infuriated Theodore Roosevelt more than to hear Wilson called an idealist. You've quoted some of those adjectives that he used. I mean, those are actually some of the milder ones. But to him, Wilson was this selfish, nasty, low sort. And to call him an idealist is just horrible. So that's something to be careful with.
Well, what about his Presbyterian upbringing and the way that that might have had an influence on how he saw the world?
Well, it's pretty hard to get away from it. Son, grandson, nephew, later son-in-law of Presbyterian ministers, born in a manse, grew up in manses also. For some of that time, his father was on the faculty of a theological seminary, so you get all of that. I think that's important to him, but I think it's important more as background, as something he really took for granted. I mean, this was a liberal, sophisticated, religious man. To him, The whole quarrel between science and religion was uninteresting. You could have it both ways. Interestingly, by the way, his uncle, James Woodrow, was an early casualty in the evolution battles. He was kicked off the faculty of the seminary in Columbia, South Carolina, because he taught the reconcilability of Darwin and the Bible. And they all thought this was the most ridiculous thing, that the church had just besmirched itself with that kind of silliness.
What about Wilson as a Southerner, though? I mean, there is this image of him at the age of, three or four, looking up at this heroic figure of Robert E. Lee.
No, that's not quite true. The earliest memory, he said the earliest memory he had was of great excitement down in Augusta, Georgia, where they lived, that Lincoln had been elected. So that's November 1860. It's a dim childhood memory. The heroic figure he saw, well, not so heroic figure, was Jefferson Davis in irons in a wagon being transported, after being captured, being transported through Augusta. He once said, the South is the only place where things don't have to be explained to me. But I think that's another one that you have to be very careful with. His parents were both from Ohio. In fact, his mother had been born in England. He is the only president between Andrew Jackson and Barack Obama who has a foreign-born parent. He is the only president since Andrew Jackson who has no American-born grandparents. So his roots in this country are not deep. His roots in the South are not deep. His father did become an ardent Confederate. That is true. But Wilson actually wanted to de-emphasize the Southern background. And when he ran for president in 1912, seeking the Democratic nomination, there was a real fault line in the South between his supporters and the supporters of the regional candidate Oscar Underwood of Alabama. And it really was – it's kind of odd. The ones who were attracted to Underwood were either the left or the right, the agrarian radicals on one side and the old bourbon state rights Democrats on the other. But what they had in common was to them they wanted Southerners to be real Southerners, whichever way they defined it. And Wilson was not. And I think I said back in that first book, Emily, that that I think the fault line was between reconstructed and unreconstructed Southerners. In other words, Southerners who wanted to get back with the national mainstream and in some ways be more like Northerners. Now, there's a limit to that. So you've got to be careful. You've got to be very careful with the, quote, Southerness of Wilson. When it comes to the most sensitive, sorest topic about him, race, I think he's more like the majority of white Northerners of that time than he was like quite like the majority of white Southerners.
Can you talk a little bit more about that, the sort of
sure.
racism and the sort of, I don't know, the not-so-heroic parts of his
story? No, that isn't heroic. The reason I said he's not like white Southerners of that time is that nearly all of them, at least the leading ones who left any records, in one way or another are somewhat obsessed with race. In other words, race is a big, important, ever-present category to them. Some of them, you know, the demagogues, the radicals on one side, are vicious, openly, outspokenly vicious. On the other side, you have those who are polite and don't want to make a big deal out of it. Wilson, as the reason I say he's more like Northerners is the prevailing attitude among Northern whites at that time was, oh, that's a problem for the South. You know, just kind of leave it alone. Don't agitate it. It'll take care of itself. Wilson took that attitude too. And of course, for people of that attitude, their favorite African-American by far was Booker T. Washington. And that kind of supposedly gradualistic approach. Wilson liked Washington very much and in fact invited him to his inauguration as president of Princeton, which scandalized some of his Southern relatives that he did that. The two things that are held against him as president, and rightly so, one is that he permitted, did not initiate himself, but permitted efforts by some of the cabinet secretaries, Southern-born cabinet secretaries, to try to introduce segregation into the federal workplace. There was quite an outcry against it. The NAACP was about 4 years old at that time. They mounted a public protest. Officially, formally, they backed down. The administration backed down. In fact, they did pretty much segregate the federal workplace. And what they were also doing was reducing the number of African Americans employed by the federal government. There had been some jobs, usually lower-level jobs, that had been traditionally for African Americans. They get weeded out, essentially, under the Democrats. Wilson pretty much, his attitude was, well, if you think this is a big deal, give it a try. I mean, I think it's a very poor way to act, but he gave his cabinet secretaries lots of latitude. He was a great delegator. The other thing, of course, that actually got him more bad press, and I think continues to give him a bad press among African Americans, was he permitted the showing of Birth of a Nation in the White House.
And generally construed to be a racist film today.
Yeah, I correctly construed that way. What he did was he had known the author of the book that the film is based on, Thomas Dixon, had been a friend of his, sort of, back when they were grad students at Johns Hopkins. And, you know, they'd kept a little bit in touch since then. Not a lot. This is not a close friend. But Dixon asked, you know, Mr. President, could, you know, we do this? And Wilson actually is quite a movie fan. He enjoyed watching movies. And he's a movie fan. There's a new industry, you know, give it a boost. And clearly, I mean the irony in this, of course, this racist film is, in cinematographic terms, is a great film. Griffith was an amazing director, a real pioneer.
Well, so was Leni Riefenstahl.
Well, that's right. We do have another example there. So Wilson permitted it to be shown. In fact, Dixon thought he was pulling off a coup. He actually brags to Wilson's secretary, Joe Tumbley, we put one over on you. You know, this is real propaganda to make every white boy in the North a Democrat, meaning a racist, you know, there's to spread the word there. The evidence we have is that Wilson sat through about half the film, didn't react very much to it, and left, and never made any comments on it. But that then caused a hue and cry, understandably. Later, Dixon wanted another one of his films, not about the South to be, or one of Griffith's films that Dixon had worked on to be shown in the White House, and Wilson said no. And still later, he tried to put a kibosh on showing of the birth of a nation. Don't encourage that, because especially this is a real inflammatory thing to do in African-American neighborhoods. So these are bad marks for him, very bad marks, no question about it.
What about his actual feelings? In other words, not just the sort of choices he makes for political purposes, but do we know how he felt about people of other races?
We know very little. And that is interesting, because this is a man who grew up, Norman, as you said, in the South, born in Virginia, but they moved to Georgia when he was just a toddler, lived in Augusta, Georgia through the Civil War, then in Columbia, South Carolina, by the way, which was under a Reconstruction Republican government, with a large number, maybe even a majority of the members of the legislature being African American, at least one statewide officer being African American. And in all the records of Wilson's childhood, and then when you get into his young adulthood, we get more left of what he said, African Americans are practically invisible. They're just not there. This is the weird thing. I mean, they're just invisible to him. There are occasional remarks. Theodore Roosevelt made an exception and appointed a high-ranking black to an office in the South, and got a lot of the Southern white politicians made noises about that. And Wilson said, that's a bad thing to do. It might encourage miscegenation. He did make a remark just before we went into World War I that going into World War I would be a terrible thing because it would deplete the white race. But the white race in the balance vis-a-vis Asians, the yellow races, which is, again, unusual for him because he was never a yellow peril guy. What we know of his attitudes are that I don't think he thought blacks were necessarily biologically inferior. But they'd been downtrodden, you know, the environmental influences on them had left them really far behind. And maybe in a few hundred years they could catch up or more or less catch up. But that's the best we can do of getting into the inner man there. But race was something really that he wanted to go away. You know, that he thought just everything would be healthier if we just didn't pay so much attention to it.
Well, we'll find out what Wilson did pay attention to when he was president, what kind of struggles he had with Congress to achieve his goals when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Wisconsin Public Radio can be heard almost anywhere in the state. To find the programming schedule for your area, visit WPR.org and click on Studios, Stations, and Program Schedules. It's all online at WPR.org.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is John Milton Cooper, and we are talking about our 28th president, Woodrow Wilson. Tell us about some of the most important accomplishments he makes in the White House in terms of domestic policy.
Federal Reserve, income tax, Federal Trade Commission, basic antitrust law, first federal aid to agriculture, prohibition on child labor, unfortunately later struck down by the Supreme Court. 8-hour day law for railroad workers, and I think everybody concedes the nomination and successfully pushing through the Senate Louis Brandeis's appointment to the Supreme Court. Wilson is, I think any political scientist would tell you, one of the three champs as far as being a legislative president, the other two being Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson. In some ways, I think he might even make Wilson the first among these equals, because he did not enjoy advantages that the other two did.
Did he have a Democratic Congress?
Yes, he did. He did. And his majority in the House was about like FDR's. His majorities in the Senate were always narrower. What he didn't have that FDR had was the greatest domestic crisis we've ever had, greatest national emergency, and a virtual blank check, which FDR had. What he didn't have that LBJ had was, of course, having spent his entire adult life on Capitol Hill, most of it as a member of Congress, and having literally mastered one of those houses and knew it inside out. He didn't have those advantages. He was only two years removed from private life when he came into the White House. What he did was he was the first president to come into the White House with a legislative program mapped out in advance. He had done this before as governor of New Jersey. Governor of New Jersey, 2 years as governor of New Jersey was his trial run. And you can see similar patterns. In fact, you can go back to the presidency of Princeton and see certain similar patterns. I don't like to push that too far, because there are people who like to go in for the psychohistory bit and really get pretty hot and heavy, and I think incorrectly and misleadingly Freudian about that. But that's another. That's
you
a whole.
Have to have a plan, right?
That's a whole other story. What he did was he planned this out and he picked his shots very carefully. He started out with revising the tariff. The tariff in those days, tariffs in those days were what taxes are now, except Republicans wanted now cut taxes. Good times cut taxes, bad times cut taxes. Well, Republicans in those days wanted to raise the tariff in good times and bad. This was a two-way fight, though. Unlike now, the Democrats wanted to lower the tariff. They had tried 20 years earlier under their only president, post-Civil War Democratic president before Wilson under Grover Cleveland, and basically failed. That it got chewed apart in the legislative process. Something that has some real resemblances, by the way, to the fight over health care now. Then, unusually for a Republican, William Howard Taft had tried to do it 4 years earlier and had failed again because of a lot of these legislative intricacies. So this was if the Democrats, who by this time had been out of power for 16 years, and the Republicans called them the organized incompetence, either TS or CE, either way, of the country, they can't govern. You know, they lost. The Republicans had lost badly, partly mainly because they were split in 1912. But they figured, okay, yeah, we'll be out for 4 years, but we'll be back. The country will come to its senses and know who really ought to be governing them. Well, if you want to prove that you're a good governing party, you succeed where your predecessors failed. And this was the easiest shot for the Democrats because even more conservative Democrats, the Democrats were united on wanting to lower the tariff. Accompanying it was the income tax to make up for lost revenue from lowering tariff rates. The 16th Amendment had just been ratified. And I know this sounds strange to say today, but the income tax was very popular. It was something that a lot of people, Democrats, progressive Republicans, Theodore Roosevelt progressives, wanted to do. The revenue was an excuse to do it. So those were coupled together. That was his first shot. That's the first one he got through. Then there was the Federal Reserve. This was banking reform. They'd had several bad financial panics. This, again, was an idea whose time had come. Everybody, quote, everybody agreed that something ought to be done. Well, as usual, if everybody agrees something ought to be done, few people are agreeing on exactly what that is. You'll have major, major schools of thought on that. It was basically, should a reserve system be publicly or privately controlled, and should it be centralized or decentralized? Well, this was very complex. His major advisor in this, as on economic issues in the campaign, was Brandeis. And whenever they got to a sticky wicket and so forth, Wilson would ask Brandeis to come down and talk to him, and Brandeis would write memoranda on this. So fought it through for a long, you know, a long, hard struggle, and basically squared that circle. But you get the early Federal Reserve, which was changed, by the way, by reforms in the New Deal, more centralized now than it was originally, was a mixture of public, private, centralized, decentralized. That's how we get the banks. And as we were saying earlier, Norman, the only state in the Union that has two Federal Reserve banks is not California, not Texas, but Missouri. And that was a political payoff to a very obstreperous senator. So the Federal Reserve, that was the second one. Then the third one was antitrust reform. There had been antitrust prosecutions. There was a widespread sentiment that the Sherman Act of 1890 was too general and too vague, left too much leeway open to the courts, too much leeway open to well-paid attorneys for the businesses, that you needed to have a stronger law. That's one reproach was be you have to have a law that will be more specific, that will specify prohibited practices. But also, this is the progressive era when regulatory commissions are the great new idea that they're trying. And of course, here, the laboratory for this was right here in Wisconsin. This is where they first got tried out. And the idea was, no. What you need is to have a regulatory commission, which will continuously supervise this. So they combined them. You get the Clayton Antitrust Act, which is our basic antitrust act now. And you also get the creation of the Federal Trade Commission. So those are the big three. That's in his first 2 years. Wilson did something, another thing no president had ever done before. He kept Congress continuously in session. He called Congress into session in April 1913, and with a slight break, and supposedly so it was first and second session, but really continuously, they stayed in session until October 1914. That's 18 months that they're at it. And remember, this is Washington before air conditioning. That's another thing.
Or a lot of fast transit.
Really, before air travel, being a congressman or senator from any place not near Washington, And even some cases there, it was like being an ambassador. You were going off and staying there, and usually they would take their families, and their families would stay there. If they had children, the children would go to school in Washington, that kind of thing.
Kind of like a full-time job.
They weren't campaigning all the time. Then what happened was the Democrats lost seats in the off-year elections. They retained the majorities, but much reduced majorities, in part because there was a recession that had started early in 1914 and might have gotten worse except the war orders from World War I from the European powers then gave a stimulus to the American economy. When Congress came back into session late in 1915, Wilson then put through another raft of legislation. This is where you get child labor, aid to farmers. They really upped the income taxes, made the income taxes take more of a bite, and passed the first inheritance tax. That was 1916. The eight-hour law for railroad workers, which is a big win for organized labor. This is something they – eight-hour day is something they'd been agitating for 40 years before this. And Brandeis to the Supreme Court. So, you know, he really carried through with a major, major program. And what he did it really by working through his party. You know, he's the man who had been the theorist of party government as a political scientist became the practitioner when he became president, first as governor and then as president.
What was the big triumph with Brandeis? Was it particularly controversial or not?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, the opposition was never openly anti-Semitic, but you know, the undertone was very much there. Brandeis was known as – if you liked him, he was called the people's attorney. If you didn't like him, he was that radical who had no respect for the Constitution. I've often thought nominating Brandeis to the Supreme Court would have been a bit as if either Carter or Clinton had nominated Ralph Nader. I mean that's the kind of – that's the kind of red flag that he raised. And interestingly, what happened was Republicans who had been progressives and insurgents – were beginning to pull back and to get in tune with the party on conservative terms again so that you only have four, I think, Republicans who voted for Brandeis, one of whom was La Follette, who was a very close friend of his. La Follette, by the way, in this is, by and large, a great supporter of Wilson's legislative programs and basically becomes what he is for the rest of his life, a party deviant. He's a deviant from just about everything in the Republican Party except, well, some things on foreign policy. But other than that, so it was very hard fought, and Wilson had to manage that. So he is a great legislative leader.
Would you call him a populist? And, I mean, did he care about, let's say, the sort of ordinary people, the poor people, the struggling
workers? He identified, interestingly enough, we'll get another UW connection here, somebody he knew rather well because Wilson – used to do part-time teaching at Johns Hopkins, and somebody he met there was Frederick Jackson Turner. And they talked a lot. They lived in the same boarding house, and Turner took some classes with Wilson. Like Turner, he very much identified with the people of the hinterlands, the South and the West. These are the real Americans. I mean, even though Wilson had lived most of his adult life in the Northeast, he never really identified with it, you know, the real Americans. So you have that sort of Jacksonian view there. Now, he was moderate in that, though. He was never all that enthusiastic about initiative, referendum, and recall. He thought that, quote, direct democracy had its real problems and that you needed the legislative filter, you needed the influence and the discipline of parties in order to really to accomplish things. Interestingly, Wilson is a disciple of Edmund Burke. But, you know, it's possible to be a Burkean without being a conservative. And that was an interesting feat, intellectual feat that Wilson brought off.
What was his unfinished business at the end of his first term?
Well, it's a good question as to where he would have gone with domestic politics. He wanted stronger intervention in labor relations. And he's at least talking about something like a minimum wage. Wanted to strengthen the Federal Reserve, wanted to have more stronger regulation over transportation. You can see the germs of the New Deal there. I mean, I think there was a real continuity between Wilson's program, the New Freedom, and the New Deal. And he once said, you know, this is a man who said a lot of things deliberately, but one of his offhand remarks that we all quote because it's too good to pass up was right after he was elected president, he commented privately offhand to a colleague for the Princeton faculty. He said, "It would be an irony of fate if my administration had to deal chiefly with foreign problems, for all my preparation has been in domestic affairs." I mean, this is a man who clearly clearly preferred to be a domestic president, and legislation was it for him. That's the test of a president, of any leader, is legislation.
Well, there was a very big irony looming ahead of him.
Oh, it was. It sure was.
We're going to follow Wilson into war when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities, dedicated to improving the independence, productivity, and integration of people with developmental disabilities. Info at wi-bpdd.org.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, John Cooper. Our subject, Woodrow Wilson, this president with a Southern Presbyterian background who says that it would be a great irony if he had to become a president whose main focus was foreign affairs because he was unprepared for it. And yet, as we all know, we have a phenomenon like the sinking of the Lusitania, which is the flashpoint for him. But as this man of peace and religion and progress, how does Wilson come to terms with this decision to go to war?
With great difficulty. The sinking of the Lusitania is the great turning point for the U.S. and World War I until we enter it. It creates the situation that eventually leads to it, not immediately. The Lusitania, the sinking of the Lusitania was one of those events like December 7th, 1941, September 11th, 2001. It's the shock of recognition. There was a journalist, Mark Sullivan, who wrote a history of this called Our Times, and he went around and interviewed people 10 years later. Everybody he interviewed remembered where they'd been, what they'd thought, what they'd done for the rest of the day when they heard the news of the sinking of the Lusitania. I think you and I grew up with our parents talking about Pearl Harbor that way, and we all remember September 11th that way. This was the one. This was the shock of recognition. This was the recognition that this war was not just a terrible thing that was happening to some people 3,000 miles away, too bad for them. Maybe we can help, the humanitarian aid, that sort of thing. But no. This was something that might involve us. And this creates then a long-running diplomatic duel with the Germans over the use of the submarine. Wilson pushed it to a confrontation early in 1916, about a year after the sinking of the Lusitania, and the Germans backed down. So that the immediate threat of war receded for about 8 or 9 months from the spring of 1916 until the 1st of February 1917, which is when the Germans decided to resume submarine warfare, resume and expand it in the full expectation that this would bring the United States into the war. I mean, there's no question about that. We had said, stop doing this or else. Well, okay, they said, no, we're going to do it, and the or else came true.
Was Wilson pro-English, much the way FDR would be later?
No. This would become something that a lot of revisionist historians, particularly in the 1930s, would accuse him of. We went through a period in the 1930s which was very much like the disillusionment with Vietnam. Never again, no more, this kind of thing. And how did we get in there and what nefarious things and prejudices and attitudes and bad influences got us in? It's easy to paint Wilson as an Anglophile. His mother had been born in England. His background was completely Scottish. He was a lover of English literature and culture. He loved to read Wordsworth and Shakespeare. The only traveling abroad or across the ocean he had done had always been to England and Scotland. He'd never been to the continent before he went to Paris in 1919. And he expressed, talking with the British ambassador, he expressed some sentimental things. Well, I come from your stock and so forth. But he did not direct policy that way. And in fact, later in 1916, he got quite disillusioned with the British over two things. One was their blockade policies and some of the high-handed stuff they were doing. The other was the way they behaved in Ireland. Ireland.
Big issue at this point.
The two sides in the war each had a big blot on them, which gave them a bad image. For the Germans, it was Belgium. It was their overrunning of neutral Belgium, and sure, there were some
The rape of Belgium.
The rape of Belgium. There were some exaggerations there, but you didn't need to exaggerate. It was just an awful, brutal thing that they did. And that, not propaganda or anything else, was what gave the Germans a bad image in this country. They just never got over it. But then, you know, so the British and the French look better in comparison. Got the problem, of course, you got the Russians back there who've got the Tsar, and they're not such good guys, but still. But then the British go and their suppression of the Easter Rising, this is the brutality with which they did that, and then the summary executions and that kind of thing. For Wilson and for a lot of Americans, it's kind of a plague of both your houses attitude at the end of 1916. So neutral, truly neutralist sentiment, impartiality was higher in this country at the beginning of 1917 than I think at any time since the outbreak of the war. So Wilson is faced with this. The war hawks in this country, such as Theodore Roosevelt, were furious with him that he didn't immediately declare war.
And was he sort of a pacifist to begin with? I mean, he had campaigned on that he kept us out of war.
He kept us out of war is interesting. He didn't begin that. Other Democrats did. He took it up a bit himself, not too much, but a bit later. He once said to his Secretary of the Navy, though, he said, "I can't keep this country out of war. Any damned little German lieutenant can put this country into war through a calculated outrage." First of all, the campaign took place when the threat of war had receded. Where they did use "he kept us out of war," much more so, and I think much more legitimately, was with Mexico. Wilson had resisted a lot of pressure to intervene with both feet in Mexico, to get involved in Mexico. He did send Pershing's punitive expedition in, chasing Pancho Villa, never caught him, the Osama bin Laden of his day. But that was a very limited incursion, and Pershing was under strict orders, don't engage the Mexicans, find Villa. You know, they had some incidents, but that's what they played up. They did not play up Europe. The European war in some ways had receded. It had gone away, but it had receded as an issue. Wilson was never a pacifist, actually. Theodore Roosevelt accused him of being a pacifist. That was a dirty word in T.R.'s book. Wilson, actually, he'd always kind of liked war. You know, as a kid, he had his fantasies about being a naval hero or something like that. And during the Spanish-American War, his brother-in-law said he wished he could have enlisted himself, you know, that he wanted to be Theodore Roosevelt in that. So, no, he was never a pacifist. What he had come to be very much against, and I think understandably and correctly, was just the carnage, the mechanized slaughter that we had witnessed for 2 years on the Western Front. I mean, this was madness. He calls this war deprived of all its glory.
With a little mustard gas added
Everything. Well, interestingly enough, the first gas attacks had come just before the sinking of the Lusitania. So that even though there's outrage in this country over the sinking of the Lusitania, there's almost no cry for getting into the war. There's very little interventionist talk. And even down to 1917, the majority in this country, as well as we can judge it, was either opposed. There's a substantial minority still opposed. And then the rest of them, probably a majority in between. The interventionist sentiment is very, very limited. Wilson had to wrestle this one out for himself. He wasn't pushed in by outraged public opinion. He was not pushed in by Congress. Several different observers, quite independently, said Wilson could have carried majorities in Congress either way, either to go in, as he did, or to stay out.
So what was the rationale? I mean, the Lusitania is a passenger ship.
Mm-hmm.
So far as we know, not armed, at least at the time.
I don't know whether it carried armament. Most British ships routinely carried some armament in wartime. Lusitania was carrying some munitions. It was carrying some rifles and small arms ammunition. I mean, the effect of sinking Lusitania was going to be to kill people. I mean, it was a blunder, an absolute blunder on the part of the Germans.
So what was Wilson's rationale for going into war?
Wilson's rationale for going into war was, in part, it's a couple of practical considerations. And then I think this is the one place where I think you really can see the deep religious element in him. The practical considerations were, first of all, we were basically in a naval war anyway with the Germans because he had decided on armed neutrality, tried to get legislation through Congress. A group of senators led by Bob La Follette filibustered in the sense they ran out the clock for the expiration of Congress. He did it then by executive order, which he had been advised he could do anyway. He already had the authority to do that. So we're in a naval war anyway. We've got the disadvantages of war without the advantages, which would be to coordinate our actions with the Allies, to have some possible influence on the outcome of the war. In other words, if we get into the war in a fuller way, then we can have more to say. That's the second practical consideration. Wilson had already outlined the way he wanted to build peace. In fact, he'd given a famous speech just in January 1917, the Peace Without Victory speech, in which he called for a liberal, non-punitive peace, not a peace of conquest, and for a League of Nations to empower to maintain the peace. So, as he sees it, the best way to get that kind of peace is to be part of the victorious coalition.
What kind of vote does he get in Congress to go to war?
300 and some odd to 50 against in the House and 6 against in the Senate. That's actually, for declarations of war, that's fairly high. So there's and among those who supported war, if you look at those congressional debates, they're not sure what they're buying into. It's not – there's very little of this, or we're going to get in there, make full-throated common cause with the Allies. We're going to fight on the Western Front as well. You know, we're fighting on the seas already. We'll supply, give some more supplies and more money and that kind of thing. So that's not there. Where the religious element comes in is at the very end of his speech. By the way, I think that Wilson's war address is possibly the greatest presidential speech since Lincoln's second inaugural.
It's not as well known as so many other speeches.
It's a beautiful speech. It's a very somber speech. It's not a victorious cry for a holy war. Not at all. He ends with a peroration, you know, what we're going to fight for, and there's an echo of the Declaration of Independence, of our sacred honor. There are very Lincolnian elements in there about spending our blood. And then his very last sentence, America will do such and such and such and such, and then he says, God helping her, she can do no other. There's a downbeat on that. That sentence is an exact paraphrase of Martin Luther. Martin Luther to the Diet of Worms. God helping me, I can do no other. I think this is where Wilson really did delve deep down into his background and his thought. Because basically what he's doing is casting the United States in the same role that Luther cast the Christian. That Christians live in a sinful world. We're all sinners. You know, in Adam's fall, we sin it all. And how do you behave then? What do you do? You can't presume to know God's will. I once made a comment that Wilson did not go into World War I because he thought God was telling him to do it. And I added, that's not a criticism of the way a certain Republican president took us into war. It's not a criticism of the way McKinley took us into war in 1898. But the Christian, you can't know God's will. What you can do is you can pray, you can read Scripture, and you do the best you can. And as Luther said, you can't avoid sin, so he said, sin boldly. Essentially, I think that's what Wilson is saying for the United States will do. We are the most righteous nation, best nation in the world, but we're still sinners, and this is the greatest collective human sin in history, and for the sake of trying to do the best we can, and the best we can by our imperfect lights, this is what we ought to do.
Did it end the war? I mean, we go in April of 1917 was the declaration of war, April 1st, I think. It's over by November 11th of 1918.
Yes, it did. We ended the war in several ways. One is we were able to keep enough supplies and money coming to the Allies that they could hang in there. It was the British and the French who were able to hang on one last time and stop the big German offensive in the spring of 1918. Really before we arrived in any great numbers. But then we're there to push back. And the war plans were for an invasion of Germany in 1919, and we would have the major role in that. So the Yanks are coming. I mean, that's if the Yanks hadn't been coming, I don't think the Allies could have held out. But Wilson's peace initiatives, basically the 14 points, and promising that this is not going to be such a bad peace for the Germans, that induced them to surrender. I think Wilson shortened the war by at least several months, maybe a year, and untold destruction and loss of life. I mean, an awful lot of people in the world, in Europe, and a lot of Americans in uniform, I think owed their lives to Woodrow Wilson, and he did not get a lot of credit for that.
You published an op-ed piece in the New York Times in the fall called Obama's Prize, Wilson's Legacy, looking at the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, well, that's a study in contrast because Obama got it at the very beginning of his presidency based upon promise. Wilson got it at the very tail end of his presidency based upon his contribution.
And he'd already suffered a stroke.
He suffered a stroke in October 1919. This is when he was engaged in this battle with the Senate over consent to the Treaty of Versailles, which contained the League of Nations. And that is the worst episode of presidential disability we've ever had. I mean, essentially, we didn't have a fully functioning president for the rest of his term, which is about 17 months there. And it's a tribute to the orderliness and delegation of his administration that the government kept working as well as it did. It wasn't great, but it kept working. And I think the most unfortunate effects of the stroke on him was not physical but psychological, because there is, I think there's a kind of Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde quality about him, that he'd been a very resourceful and very canny political leader up to this point. But this is where you get the rigid, unbending, and I think, frankly, delusional Wilson.
We could go on. It would be quite fascinating to hear about how the White House worked in those 17 months and the fate of the League of Nations and how all that worked or didn't. You can get some insight into it if you tap into our previous conversations with John Cooper from some years ago. But for now, we'll let it go at that and say thank you very much for joining us again, John Cooper.
It's a pleasure as always, Norman. Emily.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.